Ryan Serhant, founder and CEO of the real estate company Serhant, which did $7.2 billion in residential sales last year, expecting more, of course, this year.
Yeah.
Your executive producer and lead character in Owning Manhattan, a Netflix series, reality show. You are also a major social media influencer and a best-selling author. What don't you do? Ryan Serhant, welcome to The Property Play.
Oh, thank you. What an intro.
When we first started thinking about these podcasts, it was, you know, Property Play is focused entirely on commercial real estate, residential all aside. And I said, oh, what a bummer, because we can't have Ryan on the podcast because he would be so great. And then I start watching Owning Manhattan. And what do you have? You have a broker who is doing commercial real estate. Boom,
yes.
Ryan's on.
Here we are.
Why are you, you know, you're so focused on residential. That's how most people know you. But then all of a sudden you're selling, you know, trophy buildings in Manhattan for retail, for, you know, event spaces, office. Why get into commercial?
The opportunity was presented to us when COVID hit and the market was locked down. And there were a lot of our clients who are the CEOs, CFOs, CROs, head of facilities for a lot of institutional players and family players who own, you know, commercial buildings, who just said, listen, I think the market's shifting. We want to get the highest price in the shortest period of time. We need to actually market these buildings. The standard process in commercial of it's priced, we have a pro forma, we have a data room, we run a process, we know who's going to buy this anyway, is great when the market's liquid and moving. But when everything stopped in 2020, especially for commercial, you had to really, really stand out. And we had massive opportunity. I've always sped into the curve, not just in commercial, but in everything. And I also do not believe we're building a real estate company. I believe we're building a real estate ecosystem that touches the entire lifespan and style of the consumer. So we help you where you rent, where you buy, where you work, and everything in between. And I think people are looking for consolidation across services, and we can provide that in a way that other real estate firms just can't.
So what was your strategy in commercial when everyone's saying office is dead, retail is dead, Manhattan is dead? You know, that was during COVID. Obviously, it's come back, but valuations are still nowhere near what they were.
Yeah, it depends on the asset type, right? I think like office trophy class A in Midtown is $90 a foot, you know, as an example, which hasn't moved considerably from early COVID or kind of the 2019, 2018, but absorption has gotten much stronger. If we just talk about, you know, office, because we spend a lot of time thinking about where people are going to work and the return back to office, you have, you know, holistically, you'd look at like 9 to 10% vacancy would seem about average. In trophy in New York City right now, you're seeing like sub 4%. People are back and they're actually there. So, you know, 2 years ago, we spent a lot of time talking about the difference between tenanted and vacant space. So they might have a lease, but they're not actually showing up. So you had really, really dark buildings, but they were fully leased up. Today, you have people coming and going. I mean, you can see it, the traffic, the subway, the restaurants. It's incredibly, incredibly busy.
And that's for your trophy buildings. Do you see a strategy in the conversions, or do you not want a piece of that?
No, we definitely have a piece of it. The first building I ever did in new construction was in 2009, 99 John Street, when Rock Rose split up the three brothers. They went into a hat and they, you know, the Alganian brothers, and TF Cornerstone was created. And then Rock Rose was over here. And one of the buildings that TF Cornerstone got was 99 John. It was the AIG insurance building. And then the market crashed and we were brought in to sell those units. And that was an office to residential conversion. And there's plenty of opportunities for kind of the, I would say like the big box rebirth. Like this building, as an example that we're in right now, is our office. It's a clubhouse. This building was built for retail. It was Tommy Hilfiger for a while, but then nobody wanted to go to the third floor, even pre-COVID, to buy jeans, and it sat vacant for a long time. So
great opportunity for you.
Serhant should not be in a massive building in the center of Soho, but it's a great opportunity for us. And obviously, like we pay real rent here.
And what kind of, you know, we keep talking about this new surge of capital that's been sitting on the sidelines looking for somewhere to invest, and real estate has been the recipient of that in the last, even just in the couple of months.
Yeah.
We've seen commercial real estate deal making really starting to surge back. So what kind of money are you seeing on the sidelines for commercial buildings, not just in New York, but in all of the markets you serve?
Considerable. And we're seeing the money come from people that have never touched commercial real estate before. Because in certain parts of not just the city, but parts of Florida, parts of the Carolinas, like there is, I think, a price stabilization that has come from, I think, just excess debate and thought process. And now, honestly, we've got 3 years of high rates. So a lot of these owners, if they're sitting on, you know, adjustable mortgages, if they're trying to figure out what to do, they're kind of starting to get realistic for the first time. And so buyers are coming in and pouncing on things. We're doing a deal in the city right now, a commercial deal, that maybe I can talk about it by the time this goes live, maybe not. But they ran through every commercial brokerage under the sun, and they always thought the buyer was going to be institutional, it was going to be a hospitality, or it was going to be an office use, right? Highest and best use. And we came in and we said, I don't think so. I think there's potentially an end user case here. And they said, that's crazy. CBRE, Cushman, Newmark, JLL all said that that would never happen. That is the buyer that's about to sign a contract on that property right now, is an end user purchaser who has lots of different uses for it. And they're going to...
How did you know that? How did you see that?
I think, what did Wayne Gretzky say? Like, my job's not to know where the puck's been, it's to skate to where it's going. Like, my job is not to predict the future at this company. It's to build a company that will succeed in any version of it. And one of those versions is in the repurposing of commercial assets. Now, we have yet to be hired to sell, you know, a $5 billion, you know, operation, but we will get there.
But what percentage commercial are you now?
We are about 10%.
And you want to grow that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Does it dilute the brand, though? Because we think of Sirhan as high-end residential.
No, I don't think so. I'm starting to have conversations now to bring branded residences and that idea into the commercial space, which has never been
done
before.
That's what I want to get to. And that's when we get it, because I have to do a little residential. So we're jumping up. But like, let's go there. You are rapidly expanding. You expanded into Florida, of course, early on. You're expanding into Boston most recently. And branded residences seem to be, you know, whether it's just for condos or even rentals, et cetera, the Mercedes building. What we've seen branded before, it's not entirely new, but it seems to be surging right now. Is it something that only works in flashy Miami or in Florida, or maybe a little bit New York and LA? Because I don't see branded anywhere else, but you seem to be leaning very heavily into that.
You see branded in for sale product. So you see it in condo residences because you can afford the licensing fees and the types of deals you have to structure with brands. And a brand provides certainty.
So Mercedes.
For sure.
What is it telling the buyer?
One, it tells the buyer that there's certainty of the product. You have connected your brain with luxury when you think of Mercedes since the 1940s. So it's still luxury. You know, we have people show up to the Mercedes sales center in Brickell from South America, from Egypt, and they come with their Mercedes keychain. And they have a Mercedes hat on, and they tell us stories about how they were the little kids and they grew up poor. They saw someone go by in a Mercedes Benz, and since they were 8 years old, that to them said they've made it. So the opportunity to buy an apartment in the first Mercedes branded residence in North America isn't even a question.
And we see it with cars a lot, right? We saw it with, I think it was either Bentley or Rolls Royce branded.
Yeah. Because a car shouldn't just take you to your destination. It should be the destination. That's why you see it. Also, automobile brands really over the past 15 years have moved into kind of new layers of consumer success. So, you know, you see Mattel doing the same thing in toys. So let's go make the Barbie movie. Let's do this. Let's do that. Everyone is trying to diversify their revenue streams. And so how do they take brand loyalty, which is certainty, and bring that into other venues where you can find trust, where you also, especially with cars, especially with expensive cars, you have a consumer base that's already built in at a global scale that is used to spending lots of money on something they could not have, right? Or could spend a lot less on. There's cheaper cars than Mercedes. But bringing that into office and bringing that into commercial, I think, is really interesting.
But
especially
isn't it
now
already
seeing...
there? I mean, you look at the Louis Vuitton building, right? That is a branded building, right? It is literally a Louis Vuitton bag.
Yep.
How do you make that into an office? Why would an office, if they have their own brand, they have their own company, they're going to use a different brand, they're going to use their own, is that really branded residence in commercial?
I don't think offices and companies that are signing office leases are selling lifestyle to their employees as much as they should be, right? You see it now. It's changing. You see what Citadel's doing. You see what JP Morgan, obviously, that just has done.
That's their brand.
That is their brand, but they're also creating lifestyle around that opportunity to come to work. And it is a decision. You see, you know, higher education is doing it now. You see different, you know, campuses are getting together and saying, how are we going to get the kids to come to us and not go elsewhere or just not go to college at all, right? Or not go to graduate school at all. And a lot of that is in the ecosystem that you provide on the campus. And you can do that in office too. I think it would be really, really cool. And JP Morgan wouldn't do this. The bigger brands wouldn't do it. But a lot of companies would say, you know what? I could get office space there. But hey, that really cool branded office where like they also did the three restaurants that are on site, plus the gym that's on site, plus there's a concierge service. Let's pay the extra $30 a foot to go lease there. People are really going to want to come and work for us. There is a fight for great talent across the board.
Even if it's a different brand that's behind it than their own.
Yeah, because you still have your company. You're the 10th floor of the Mercedes office building. Why not? And it doesn't mean you have to have the retail tenant be that brand. That's the only place where it starts to get complicated.
Have you been able to sell that commercially yet, that idea?
Working on it. We're doing the first branded residences right now in Tampa. We announced it on Monday. Roche Bobois in St. Pete. Yeah. So kind of a really cool, very fancy European brand, and doing branded residences. And I only bring this up because it's the first branded residence that's ever been done in Tampa. Ever. You see it in Miami all the time. You very rarely see it elsewhere. And the amount of interest we have already just from our social exposure and announcing this thing to our audience, which is large, will be sold out in a matter of weeks. It's nuts.
So that would make you competitive in that commercial space. I want to get back to the competition of Sirhan in residential, which, you know, you're taking on Compass recently. You had a couple of things to say about them in the news that came out, that you see that they are a platform for property. And you saw that as, I don't know if it was a criticism necessarily because they are your primary rival, but, you know, if they are a property platform, what's wrong with that? You say you're a people platform, but you're selling property.
But we're not selling property. Like, we sell the people. The agent is our customer every day. And I think you have to make a decision when you're running a business like we do. Is the agent going to be your product that you are going to love, care for, die for, build for? Or is the agent going to be the byproduct of something bigger that you're trying to achieve? I think Compass has made, obviously, a very, very big and public bet on saying the agent is the byproduct to bring consumer mindshare to a property platform so they can take down Zillow. That's what they want to do, because Zillow gets to take all of the inventory and sell leads back to all the agents with none of the operating expense. That's why they trade at a higher multiple. They have higher gross margins, and I totally get it. And I'm all for that battle, and they should go and do that. We operate very, very differently. You know, our tools are different. We are an AI native business, and maybe that's because I'm a salesperson and I understand what it's like to be an agent on the street, whereas most of my competitors are more professional fundraisers than anything else.
And because you based your company on selling Ryan Sirhan to begin with, right? I mean, that's how you started out. That's how you made it at the beginning. But it's still, look, let's be honest. If anybody who watches Owning Manhattan says, you know, is it about all those agents or are you the main character? And you are, and you bring them all together. And even some of your agents say, in one of the episodes, I saw them say, well, it's so much about being absorbed by Ryan that we're not getting the attention to our personal brands because Ryan absorbs that.
I think some of them are dramatic. I think that...
You think?
I think that, well, yeah. Listen, at the beginning, for sure, right? So we sat and we thought long and hard about what to name this place. I really tried not to name it after myself. I thought the liability is high. I think, you know, who knows what could happen in the future.
I'm surprised by that.
But look at any other.
But you are the brand.
But it sometimes it takes a second to get there. And we really did an exercise to come up with a brand that could stand alone from me, which is really what I wanted to create. But what we realized in talking to agents all over the world, especially through our education business, which has 45,000 agents
in
133 countries and growing every day. And consumers and developers, is there's never really been a brand like ours before. And instead of leaning away from it, lean in. Like, lean in as hard as you possibly can. And what has proven to us is that our customer acquisition cost, because of the strength of the brand, in the upcoming generation of home buyer, seller, and agent, is zero. My LTV to CAC is unlike anything this industry has ever seen, because we generate
lead flow. Because they just come to you.
All day, every day. And you have to remember, our agents grew up with me. Right? They watched $1 million listing in 2013 when they were in seventh grade, you know, 12th grade with their parents. They followed my journey across social, and I've always tried to just speak my mind, say it how it is, make mistakes, own them. And owning Manhattan is a founder's journey more than anything, right? It's kind of the me against the world and see what's going to happen, and going through the hiring and firing process and the beautiful New York City and all
the
that
eye
stuff.
Candy.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that there's, it's been a massive global megaphone for me to put out to the world that we're building something differentiated in the marketplace. And if you want to be a part of it, you can come and we'll see if you're the right fit for us. And if not, no problem. We're happy to do deals with you on the sidelines.
And you're also differentiating yourself in AI, launching Simple.
Yeah.
Explain what Simple is, simply.
Simple is Instacart for work. 3 years ago, I was trying to figure out how to solve the problem of time, which is really what I wanted to do. As a salesperson myself, I don't ever want to build anything that I think someone wants, right? I want to give them what they didn't even know they needed. And a lot of agents spend, on average, about 80% of their day doing administrative tasks. It's pricing properties, listing presentations, it's email, it's calendar, it's all the stuff. Okay.
It's the job.
It's the job. And then 20% of the day doing what only a human can do.
Sell,
which is have conversations, which is giving you information that I was given over here, right? Going back and forth and putting deals together. That 20% is built on trust, which is something that AI can't replicate. I sold a property last year, the single most expensive residential deal in all of 2025 I did in Florida last year. And the buyer of that property, after the closing, shows me that he's reading Sell It Like Sirhan, the book I wrote in 2018, and it gave me like a heart attack. So it's like, my clients can't read my books. You'll know all my secrets, my wow moments, how I
As
sell.
As if you keep anything secret.
You know, he spends a lot of time in the AI space and is incredibly involved. It's like, why are you reading this? It's like, AI is going to remove or democratize a lot of tasks, but it will not remove the skill set of building trust and your ability to actually sell. So Simple takes that 20 and we flip it. So the people at this company, the agents who use it, which is everybody, they spend 80% of their day now selling, 20% of their day monitoring administrative tasks, which have now been done for them.
But what happens when the AI starts to eat into that new 80%, that is the selling? Because you showed these AI goggles where a person could walk through an apartment and
awesome.
See the whole thing. It's
yeah.
awesome, right?
And why not?
AI generated everything. But if I can do that, why do I need an agent to walk me through that apartment? Why do I need to even come to New York City if I can do everything virtually? Why do I need a person if AI gets to the point, not now, I know it's not now, but 5-10 years from now, that it looks like a person, it sounds like a person, it sells like a person, it has learned from Ryan Serhant how to be a great salesman. Why do I need an actual person?
Sounds like you'll need Serhant at that time. I mean, again, I am not naive to what the future could potentially look like. When COVID hit, one of the reasons this company moved so fast is starting in 2013, I started making property tours on YouTube, which was a joke. There was kids stuff and that was about it on YouTube. And I would go and I would meet with developers and I would meet with sellers and I would say, no, this thing had just been created. I don't know if you're on it, but it's Instagram. We need to make sure that we can take photos of your home that look beautiful on Instagram. And I was laughed out of the door. People that I compete with to this day made fun of me. They wrote articles making fun of us from 2013 up until kind of the late teens. But then what we had when COVID hit was we had a multiple terabyte bank of video and virtual tours that for a long time, no one knew why you needed. And all of a sudden, I could go to market and I could sell our properties through video in a way that every other firm was trying to. Videographers were not essential workers, right? An agent with a phone couldn't figure out how to do this. And we built Sirhan Studios incredibly, incredibly fast. And we were able to take significant market share in the markets that we were in because we were just 1,000% ready. I was just 7 years slightly too early, which is okay. And so I kind of take that same approach to what we're seeing now. I don't think AI is a displacer. I don't think it is the savior that I think some sought a word. I think it is, sure, a disruptor, but I think more than anything, it is an empowerer. I think the work just changes. If I can sell something overseas, because you can do it virtually and you can talk to the me or to one of our Sirhan agents and you feel as comfortable with them, there is still, because it is a legal process, there is still going to need to be a human who's monitoring that transaction, and that human will work here. And that's just the way the future is going to be.
So in your view, why is it? And I know Sirhan is not a publicly traded company yet. But recently we saw the stock market go after the commercial real estate companies. We saw stocks of JLL, yep, CBRE, Cushman and Wakefield plummet 20%, simply because there were, you know, Elon Musk did a video podcast where he talked about there being nobody in offices in a couple of years. And and there were another social media posts about commercial real estate getting hit. And just like the software stocks got hit, those stocks tanked in one day, the same day that CBRE reported record earnings.
Yeah, good buying opportunity.
Well, that's what the analysts said. But
scare trades, for sure.
Scare trades. But going forward, what does that say about what markets and what equity thinks about what AI is going to do to these companies?
I don't think anyone has any idea. I think they operate strictly based on what they see, and they make as good of an educated guess as they possibly can. I think if, you know, over the past 2 weeks, it was the commercial real estate sector that was being hammered, everyone's going to forget and move on. And then they're going to go after the automobile industry, once you can see the Optimus robot putting a car together, right? And to Elon's credit, he's really great at telling a story and building a narrative to the benefit of the puck he's skating towards 1 to 2 years from now. Not having human bodies in offices is really, really great for robots, right? That's good for Optimus robots. And that's a big, you know, part for them. They're shutting down car plants right now to make more room for robots. And that's going to be a big future. Why not?
If I can go use after those the home builders. I mean, you're 3D printing homes, so you don't need any people to do the construction. You're more efficient. But what about those salespeople and, you know, and all the major home builders who have massive selling teams?
I think you see it across price points in very different tranches. So we don't need bookstores on every corner to buy books anymore. But if you want to find luxury books, the most expensive books, rare collectible items, you're still going to go to McNally Jackson. You're going to talk to them and say, I can't find this on Amazon, because Amazon cares about the lowest cost product in the shortest period of time, which isn't everything. I think in real estate, what we don't have is we don't have cheap books. Rates are too high. Capital's too expensive. Labor costs are high. Even if the labor is AI robots, what we need is houses. we need more homes. If we can use technology to build more homes, if we can have access to more federal land, there's so much more opportunity out there, and you'll have great job creation. And that's the focus.
So, and that's what the argument some of the analysts who called it a buying opportunity was, that AI is simply going to make everything more efficient. And that means we're going to be able to sell more efficiently going down the road. But Barry Sternlicht, you know, who is a real estate mogul of our time, said on this podcast, quote, I'm terrified. Why are you not terrified?
I'm younger. I'm just beginning my journey here. I was a real estate agent for 12 years. I started this company 5 years ago, and we were AI focused, you know, at the beginning of what we've been building. I'm not trying to steer a huge ship that is, you know, coming under attack. I'm building in the war. And I think the products you build in battle will stand the test of time against those that had to take all of the war wounds, right? And AI has been a huge part of our process from the beginning. I'm a salesperson. If I can use technology to sell property to anyone, anywhere, on any device, at any time, I will take that opportunity. The only thing that stops me from doing that now isn't just tech. It's Department of State guidelines. It's licensure law. You know, so there's a lot more lobbying that has to get done to enable, kind of like you have stock traders, to enable salespeople to do more with less regulation. I don't know if anyone's going to move that way, but if they do, it could be incredible for us.
So what are you, you talked about your best-selling book and you started teaching in 2018 through that book. You continue teaching now online. You talked about your Sell It platform. Tell me why it's so important to you. I mean, you would think that someone at your level would want to keep his strategies, his under-the-radar plays, which is what we focus on here, to himself. Why are you constantly teaching and selling that you're teaching and putting it online out there when this is, isn't this your secret sauce?
No, I think one of my abilities to give back is to teach that next generation of salesperson who also, in huge part, comes to work here. I knew I was going to start my own company a long, long time ago. I just didn't know exactly when, but I had the opportunity to go into ed tech and to build a sales training platform for salespeople all over the world before we started Serhant. And one of the reasons we did that wasn't just to make money or build a unique business. It was to train the next generation of people who were going to, for profit, want to open up Serhant at a global level. I have been building in the side door Serhant advocates for 15 years now, just waiting patiently.
So you're training. I mean, it's Serhant school, essentially. Yeah. That's what the Sell It platform is.
Yeah.
So how big do you expect Serhant? I mean, I know you're going to say, the sky's the limit. But even your wife said on the show, when is enough enough?
I don't know. I don't plan on ever dying. So it depends, my goal is to create something that can obviously exist without me and really, really support that salesperson who wants to be as supported as possible to build the biggest life. I think the sales career is an incredible career. There is no ceiling. There's also no floor, right? So it's not for everybody. And we'll build this as large as the market wants us to. Maybe a good context here is my initial plan. It wasn't always to start my own company. It would have been way easier for me to go to another brokerage firm, but I met with all of those firms and they all suck. And so what was I supposed to do? So I had to go and do this. And I blame everyone else for forcing me to do it.
But, it's all about competition though, right? You went out there, you saw that everything sucked. On your show, and I do want to get into the show, even though it's not specifically commercial real estate related, because it just tells so much about what you do, how you do it, how you manage, and not just how you sell. And so the first thing I have to ask is, how much of that is real?
It's unfortunately way too real. I wish. I wish it was scripted. I wish we would sit there and say, hey, let's create some dramatic moments. It's the worst.
And yet there will be a season 3, I imagine.
You know what my superpower is? Someone said to me, is ignorance. If I knew then what I knew now, I would never, ever, ever have started my own company. It is so hard and it is so personally taxing. And there's just such an easier way to live your life. But I didn't know that at the time. I had to go do it. Even now, the things we're doing, like I'm going to open 11 states this year. I should not do that.
But you're a luxury brand, though, or at least that's how you originally sold yourself. If you're, opening up, and I think it's Georgia is one of the states, right?
Yeah.
Are you only doing luxury, the highest end Georgia residences, or going into Atlanta and doing that? Or do any agents sell a home less than $1 million?
Well, the starter home price on average in over 300 cities is now about $1.2 million, right?
In cities. The median home price, though, is around $400,000.
Correct. And we sell those homes, too. We are not number one in those markets. Those are cap model firms.
So why get into it? Why not? I mean, again, I go back to diluting the brand because it's, and I, maybe I'm too old, but people might not know what the Benetton effect is. But when I was in high school and I grew up in Manhattan, Benetton was this clothing company, this Italian brand that everybody got really into really fast. And there were Benettons everywhere, all over Manhattan. There was one on either side of Bloomingdale's. Literally, they were competing across Lexington Avenue from each other. And for about 2 years, Benetton was everything. And then they all suddenly disappeared because it was just oversaturation, because maybe they weren't focusing on what their core brand was. Do you worry at all about getting too large, diluting that brand again?
My core target is a luxury salesperson who provides a luxury service. It's not necessarily the luxury market. Like when we went to Florida, for example, everyone said, you got to go to Miami and Palm Beach first. And I said, I think I'm going to go to Delray. So we went to Delray, I went to Orlando. And all of our competitors then said, all right, well, I'm not going to pay attention to Sir Ann. They did it the wrong way. And what happened? Not only am I now number one in Delray, for example, but now we are taking all market share in Palm Beach. Now we're growing incredibly quickly in Miami because I took a Walmart approach to it. Instead of just going into the epicenter, which is way too expensive to compete to being across the street from the biggest stores, I went around and I let everybody else in the bigger marketplaces say, whoa, 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 whoa. Why did you do it the wrong? What are they doing? How come it's worth? Wait, they could sell that in Delray for how much? They did what? How come everyone's just, can you come here? Can you come here, please? Because my company doesn't care about me because I am a byproduct of their main mission. And I grew up with you, Ryan, and I want you to focus on me. And that's what's happening. We are only expanding because the market is asking us to. Like, my life is fine. I don't need to be in all these markets, but the business needs to be because it is in such demand. And so what am I supposed
to do? So I have to.
What am I supposed to do?
But at the same time, you're saying, you said it yourself, everybody's waiting for me to fail. And yet you keep growing.
Yeah, my desire to win is far greater than everyone's desire to watch me fail, that's for sure. I don't know. Like, what else am I going to do? Like, I don't play golf. Like, I don't like boats, you know, like I've had this suit for like 11 years and it still fits me, by the way. Like I've worn these bracelets since 2014 and they've never come off. Like, I don't know what other people do. I wait through the weekends to get to Monday and I really like, you know, getting to work. I think it's, I think work is worthy. And I think it's an incredible opportunity to be here to build with really, really great people who have a get up and go mindset. And I think that at a lot of companies that I compete with, I think the mission's been lost. I think one of the things that separated us, and you can actually see it in our hallway here, if you get B-roll of it, in 2020, COVID, New York City empty, SWAT on the streets, two of us sat in a abandoned office with construction paper and said, we're going to go start this company. What do we need to do? We need policy manuals. And we wrote it all down. And I said, we're going to follow, these are my four P's, purpose first, then people. If we have a clear, defined purpose and we can find the people that match the purpose, we can sell any product. And if you do that, we don't even have to think about the profit. A lot of our competitors, it's profit first. They sat in a room and said, where can we make money? And when you focus on the money, it can work out sometimes, but then you got to go find a product to make the money for, and then you got to find people to make the product, and then you hire a consulting firm to say, give us a purpose. I need a purpose on our website. What's our purpose is to, and they don't remember. And I think people come here for the culture. I think they come here for the purpose. And I think there's a real trust and alignment in the brand because of that.
But you haven't said what the purpose is specifically.
Our purpose is to help the world move forward. We help people move their careers forward. We help people move forward in their lives through their homes. We help developers move forward in their missions to build buildings. We help banks move forward to lend more. We have a massive partnership with JP Morgan. I am the face of home lending at JP Morgan. I'm the face of T-Mobile for the mobile enterprise economy now through Super Mobile. It's why my phone will, unfortunately, it's a bad thing because I never lose service now. Like, I used to lose service in tunnels. Now I'm forever reachable. It's a whole separate combo. Anyway, and that is that's the mission, and that's what we're doing.
And the money doesn't hurt, though, I imagine. We can't be so naive to say that it is all about purpose. Or is it? I mean, look, you said jealousy is wasted energy. You said that on your show. And yet your entire show is based on agents being jealous of each other.
That's what people also want to watch.
Right. So that's why I ask you, is your show real? You say it's all about purpose.
Yeah.
From what I watch, and I've watched you over the years, I watched you on Million Dollar Listing. Unfortunately, I wasn't a teenager at the time, but I have watched Ryan Serhant grow into what he is now. And a purpose is fantastic. But the drive, the Ryan Serhant drive to get into commercial real estate, to continue to grow the residential building business in places that you wouldn't expect Serhant to go, it sort of begs the question, yes, there's a purpose, but is that drive that it's never going to be enough, that I'm jealous of something out there that I don't have, that I have not achieved, because purpose of growing, of moving others forward is not Ryan Serhant's own purpose? What drives Ryan forward?
I think sometimes people confuse my ambition with responsibility, right? It's not, yes, sure, I'm ambitious. I want to build, I want to grow, but I do feel responsible. I was telling our agents, we do our weekly Serhant Lives and we have special guests and things. And I was telling them, I think on the one last week, was reminding them that if people had any idea how many other people win when Ryan wins, they'd understand that it's not greed, it's not ambition, it is pure responsibility. And watching other people win, I think is something that I get a lot of joy out of that I don't think a lot of my competitors truly get a lot of joy out of. I've worked for people who wake up every day and ask themselves, what are you doing for me today? Look what I've provided. What are you going to do for me? And that is gross. I wake up every day here and I am stressed out about what I'm going to provide to the people that I am now responsible for. And that's in the DNA of the business.
Ryan Serhant, thank you.